is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, despite worries over trade wars and concerns and tariffs, the markets had another good week. After correcting briefly, we're back to the upside. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour, a special program edition and a special treat. But in hour one, we'll be speaking with Art Hill from Stock Charts. He still believes we're in a very, very strong uptrend in the market. Six out of his nine indicators remain positive, indicating stock prices could be heading higher. Later on in the program, we'll be talking with Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report as we take a look at commodities. One sector that started out to do well at the beginning of the year like everything else, but recently with the rising dollar, commodity prices have weakened, everything from gold, silver, to copper. We'll talk about why these reflect some really undervalued opportunities. That's coming up with Dave Morgan, and of course Ryan Poplava will be here talking about all the news that moved the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And coming up in hour two, the big picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss the economics of inflation. We're at a key inflection point in our economy and the markets, especially as we head into the 2020 presidential elections. Both political parties subscribe to an economic theory that has had and will have disastrous results, MMT. Or modern monetary policy. We talk about that, and in the second half of the big picture, we play Jim's interview with Jens O. Parsons, a.k.a. Ronald Marks. Though the interview is from 2013, I think you'll find it's more relevant now as the U.S. government moves toward MMT. And now, we hear from Ryan Poplava on what moved the market this week.
Thanks, Chris. There were really only two catalysts, I'd say, that all the headlines funneled into this week, trade and growth concerns. And that whipped the market back and forth this week because we got headline and information both bullish and bearish for both of those areas, with earnings coming in nicely for Cisco and Walmart and not so nicely for Baidu. So starting off, let's talk about the Chinese firing back on Trump's tariffs, which increased last week with moving to the 25% range on about $200 billion in goods. This week, Chinese fired back with a floating their tariff range from 5 to 25%, up from 5 to 10% on around $60 billion of imported goods. Now, the adjustment will go into effect on June 1st, and looking at the S&P 500, that closed down nicely on Monday, down 2.4% on the day. The volatility index spiked almost 30%, and Treasury yields fell back down to the March lows, specifically with the 10-year Treasury yield right around 2.4%. Now, there were a couple of other catalyst money that helped with the overall de-risking, including an adverse Supreme Court ruling with Apple over its App Store antitrust lawsuit, and a 40-state suit filing on allegations over drug price fixing from generic drug companies. Now, the semiconductor index, as well as copper prices, both were lower over the past few weeks, have also communicated some similar concerns over growth, and were down also on that day on Monday. But the mood began to shift slightly on Tuesday and Wednesday due to some trade headline developments. Now, Tuesday, President Trump mentioned that he has an extraordinary relationship with President Xi, and the trade dispute is just a little squabble, he called it. Additionally, Trump downplayed the New York Times article suggesting he was planning on sending 120,000 troops to Iran. And on Wednesday, there were reports Trump would delay his auto tariff decision for up to 6 months. And that's really a good choice there, because fighting a trade war on two fronts would be really tough for this market to stomach. Finally, on Wednesday, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said he plans to go to China, showing the U.S. and China are still interested in making progress. Additionally, Wednesday, there were some reports that trade rep Lighthizer has a proposal for Canada to remove the current steel and aluminum tariffs. So some beneficial trade progress across Tuesday and Wednesday. And the trade news was helpful because on Wednesday, there was retail sales and industrial production figures for April that contracted. Sales fell 0.2% after a strong March showing, and possibly due to slower tax refunds, maybe continued store closings, like I'm looking at you, Toys R Us. Such a shame. But industrial production fell 0.5% in April, the third decrease in 4 months. The manufacturing component continues to disappoint, which has been confirming what we've seen with the recent slowdown in ISM manufacturing data. Now, trade continues to be the biggest risk right now for manufacturing, and that was what was kind of discussed in some of those readings on that day. Now, Thursday, favorable earnings from bellwether Cisco and Walmart helped compound some of that recovery that we had seen taking place after the Monday sell-off through all of the trade news from Trump trying to reassure markets. Now, the earnings beat and higher guidance helped take the focus off trade for a split second. But Trump's executive order Thursday to protect the U.S. tech from foreign adversaries really hit the semiconductor space with just a really big hit. And many thought this was targeted at restricting Huawei from conducting business with U.S. companies and served as yet another trade blow, and yet something also that was brought up on Friday. On the flip side of the sour retail industrial production numbers Wednesday, Friday's University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Survey reported a 15-year high, which continues to contrast with business sentiment. Now, office space and the intent to hire remains high, translating to a strong job market. And that's not to say there aren't any annoyances to consumer sentiment, like higher gas prices, tighter lending standards, and higher core inflation. But overall, the expectation component jumped also to a 15-year high, which was driving a lot of that overall growth in that sentiment. So there you have it. Trade and growth concerns both sending mixed signals to the market this week, with various headlines posting in each of those pro and con columns. And as long as both sides continue to meet going into late May and June, although there was some news from CNBC late in the day of Friday that everything's in flux and maybe there's going to be a lot of holding taking place from any kind of meetings. And that's what pulled the market back late in the week. But there seems to be this hope that a deal can be made. And that's what seems to be holding up the stock market. However, below the surface, we do see slowing growth concerns and earnings expectations for the second half and slowing manufacturing and what seems to be some de-risking in portfolios, with treasury yields falling recently since mid-April.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Joining us on the show today is Jim O'Sullivan, chief economist at High Frequency Economics, and he's named by MarketWatch as the most accurate economic forecaster in America over the past 10 years. Jim, I know that you watch retail sales, inflation, wages, labor market, and a slew of other economic data points and trends, many of which we're going to discuss today. But Trump is now saying, he tweeted that unexpected good first quarter number, 3.2%, was greatly helped by tariffs from China. And he goes on to say that some people just don't get it, exclamation mark. What's your take on that claim as far as the positive impact that tariffs would have on U.S. GDP?
Frankly, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find any evidence that the trade battle has been positive thus far. I mean, I think the question is it worth the cost? And obviously, the judgment of the administration is that it is worth the cost in the long run. But in any event, no, I don't see any evidence that in the past year, in the first quarter, that the trade battle is anything but a negative. Now, obviously, despite that, the economy has, for the most part, been doing pretty well, but arguably it would have done even better.
Okay, now let me see if we can break this down, because I was trying to understand this in terms of the GDP calculation, right? So it's consumption plus investment plus government spending and investment plus net exports. So that's exports minus imports.
And net exports were up.
Right. So is that where Trump's claim comes into play?
What's your retirement goal? When it comes to retirement, you've probably heard it's all about achieving your number. At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe retirement is all about you. You are not a number. You can achieve your retirement dreams and goals. Let us help you create a consistent source of income, make the best choices on Social Security and Medicare benefits, and build your legacy for the future. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together and make your dreams come true. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, after reaching record levels just in about every index, we had a quick pullback. But was this just a correction in our stocks heading higher? Joining us from StockCharts.com is Art Hill. Art, there's something that really struck me as I was looking at the charts this morning, and that is if we look at the market last year, we had rising stock prices all the way into October. But we also had rising interest rates when the 10-year Treasury got up to around 3.25. Now, they both peaked in the late fall, then fell sharply. But this year, we almost have the opposite. We have had rising stock prices and falling interest rates. What's going on here?
I wish I could tell you what was going on, because there are so many factors in play, and I think Treasuries are just one factor. But yeah, you're right. There's clearly been a disconnect with the 10-year and the S&P 500. You normally think that when the 10-year yield is rising, that means, you know, the Fed is going to raise interest rates, and the Fed is not going to raise interest rates as long as the economy is strong, and that's positive for the stock market. But now we see the 10-year falling quite a bit and hitting a 52-week low, in fact, this week with that dip, and the market is rising. And I think that kind of brings me back to one of my central premises, is that if you're interested in the stock market, you have to focus directly on the stock market. The 10-year yield, as important as it may be, is still a secondary influence, as are other indicators like volume. So I would focus mainly on the stock market itself. And the S&P 500 hit a new high a couple weeks ago. So it is in a long-term uptrend. It's above its rising 200-day moving average. And I think the bulk of the evidence is bullish.
You know, it's amazing how, just reflecting back over the last 12 months, Art, if you would have told me last year where the Congress and the president passed a $1.5 trillion stimulus bill. We had $300 billion of additional spending. Corporate profits are up 25% every quarter. That we would have ended up the way we did in the final months of the year, I don't think too many people saw that coming. I mean, it just all of a sudden, boom. I mean, oil prices down 40%, and now they're up about 40% this year. When you see something that happens that suddenly, is this just a function of just money shifting from one side of the boat to the other? All of a sudden, somebody wakes up one day and says, oh my God, I didn't think of that. It's time to reverse my position.
Well, one thing about the S&P 500, it did have that big plunge in December, and then it was just a V reversal off that late December low. And if you kind of just, you can't really do this, but if you ignore the price action below 2600, it's like you have a choppy advance moving throughout 2018 and into 2019. And that, you know, spike down in December and recovery in early January is kind of like something that was irrational that came out of the blue from markets that got spooked when the Fed chairman changed his language a little bit. But I think, you know, the trend is still intact. And as far as oil, I'm not that impressed with oil, even though it is one of the best performing assets here in 2019. It's, you know, 200-day is still sloping down, and it's well below that October high. So it's, you know, in the long-term scheme of things, oil doesn't look that great.
You know, the other thing I noticed with oil, even though we've seen a sharp recovery in the price of the commodity, the energy stocks are not doing that well.
No, they're not, especially when you look at the oil and gas equipment and services ETF, the XES. That one is not doing very well. It's, you know, still above its December low, but it got hit really hard there in late April and early May. It's well below its falling 200-day moving average. So, you know, if you're looking for a stock or an ETF, this would be one to pass on because it's just not showing any relative strength or absolute strength, really.
You know what strikes me also, as we rose from the beginning of the year with the Fed pivoting and going dovish, just about every sector in the S&P was doing well. The exception is energy is not doing as well as the commodity. Materials have had a little difficulty. And then the other thing that really struck me, Art, was healthcare has been struggling here. But I mean, if you look at every other sector, consumer discretionary, consumer staples, normally you don't see them both rising at the same level, but they are. Just about every sector is doing well with just a few exceptions.
You're right. And if you do a year-to-date performance chart, technology is still the leader. It's up around almost 22% year-to-date. And in fact, that's its weighting in the S&P 500, funny enough, 22%. But healthcare is up only 2% this year, and it has gone literally nowhere since the latter part of 2018. It's almost like a big symmetrical triangle is taking shape, but it's getting a nice bounce today, and it could be poised to break out of that triangle. That triangle goes back to September.
I want to talk about the FANG stocks, which were the darlings of the market over the last 2 years. They had that brief period of time when you had companies like Amazon and Apple were becoming trillion-dollar companies. They rose along with the rest of the market, but what the heck happened in just the last week or two? You know, I don't care if you look at Alphabet or you look at Apple, they've been hit pretty hard.
Yeah, they've definitely been hit pretty hard, and they did rally back, but they are still below their October highs. So in that regard, you know, they're not in the leading group anymore. Well, Netflix is still below its June high, and it formed a lower high in October. And Facebook is also below its summer high. You know, yeah, again, they've had a big move over the last, well, since 2019 has started. Amazon is getting pretty close to its August-September highs, and it's one of the stronger ones above its rising 200-day. So I don't think, you know, they're just underperforming a bit, but I don't think they're dead. You know, I still think they have strong charts on the whole, especially Amazon being above its rising 200-day. And then if I take a quick look at Google, it's getting a bounce off of its 200-day now. But of course, it had that big gap down earlier a couple weeks ago.
Now, one thing that happened at the beginning of the year is all asset classes rose. I don't care where you were looking. Bonds were rallying. Stocks were rallying. Commodities such as gold and oil. The thing that has not done that well has been the emerging markets. They're still, I'm looking at the ETF EEM, and it's still in a downtrend, and it's been there since April.
Yeah, EEM had one of the biggest breakdowns in April, in the latter part of April. And I think the thinking is, and China's a part of this EEM, and the thinking is that if there is some sort of a trade war, that China might have more to lose than the U.S. and the emerging markets by extension. And that might be why they were hit. And so the EEM is back below its 200-day moving average, which is sloping down. And, you know, when it comes to ETFs and stocks, it's a game of relative strength and absolute uptrends. And if you don't see it leading and you don't see it in an uptrend, you just have to pass and move on to the next one.
Another area I want to talk about, and it, you know, just being a fundamental guy, I can see the impact on this eventually with the S&P, and that has been the rise in the U.S. dollar. It continues on an uptrend, and of course, we know within the S&P 500, about 40% of their sales are overseas. So sooner or later, a rising dollar has got to impact these earnings, but right now, the dollar, despite the Fed going soft, is still rising.
Yeah, it is an incredible rise. The dollar index, of course, is 57% euro. And so I think that is what is weighing the most, because the euro, for its own reasons, probably is in a steady downtrend. It's just been one lower low after another. And then since this little shock that we had is starting to wear off, maybe the yen, which is about 13% of the dollar might pull back. The yen had a big surge in May as money moved into risk-off assets. But it's an interesting thing you bring up about large caps, because small caps have been underperforming, and you would think that this strong dollar would make small caps more beneficial relative to large caps, but small caps just have not been able to outperform large caps yet.
Is that a function sometimes when you see a steep sell-off, as we did in November and December, that catches everybody by surprise? I mean, you know, everybody was making money. The FANG stocks were hitting record after record, and then boom, in a period of 6 weeks, you just lost everything. People come back into the market, but they do so, they're a little bit more cautious. How much of this has to do with maybe the cautiousness of investors?
Well, yeah, once bitten, twice shy, I think is the old saying that's at work here. And I think, though, that, you know, the recovery has been quite quick. And I don't know how much the average individual investor is active in the market. We haven't seen that euphoria yet in the stock markets. But, you know, at the end of the day, it is the institutions that are driving the prices here. And they're the ones that we got to keep an eye on. And as long as the S&P is above its 200-day, I think that, you know, favors institutional participation in the stock market.
You know, one thing that really strikes me, and I'd like to get your views being a veteran of the market, that strikes me about this bull market, it is the least loved bull market that I've seen in my entire career. Even after the bottoms that were hit in March of 2009, everybody kept expecting another crash. Looking at fund flows, individual investors have gone more into bond funds than they have stock funds. So, you know, this is a market driven by stock buybacks, where you had $500 billion of buybacks every single year in institutional. But to some extent, the individual investor has not been a major participant as he has in the past.
True. And stock buybacks have definitely contributed a lot to the market advance, because you have basically a shrinking supply, and the IPO market has not been that hot. So overall, you do have shrinking supply out there. The S&P hasn't gone really very far at all, if at all, since January 2018. You know, it did have a 52-week high, and it did have that plunge in December. Now we're just near that January 2018 high. So it hasn't gone anywhere, but it's still in an uptrend. And I think we're not going to get that final top until you start seeing some euphoria, and then you start seeing more individuals involved and people talking about it on Main Street again. When that happens, then maybe we'll have a top.
You know, you have some money managers, chief among them, Jeffrey Gundlach. He cites the New York Stock Exchange, just as you just said, really, like the S&P, hasn't gone much of anything since January of 2018. So his contention is, you know, we may be in a bearish situation, but you disagree with that, I assume.
Well, I do a weight of the evidence approach, and I have 9 breadth indicators that I watch, and they cover small caps and mid caps and large caps. And so with 9 indicators, you're always going to have a majority. At least 5 will be bullish or bearish. So you're never going to have a tie, is what I mean. You'll have a clear bias. And right now, 6 of the 9 are on bullish signals, and 3 of the 9 are not. So that tells me that, yeah, 1/3 of the market is struggling out there, and 2/3 is doing okay. And so the net is bullish, but because that 1/3, you know, that's a big chunk, that means it's more of a stock pickers and ETF pickers market. So you have to be very selective out there.
You know, the thing that really strikes me is how some key events can really turn this market around. And what I'm thinking of, Art, is when we had Chairman Powell issue some very hawkish comments in September, October, and December of last year, and the impact it had on the market. Then we also had, for example, a presidential tweet and said, oh, by the way, I'm granting waivers, and the price of oil plunges 40%. And then all of a sudden you have tweets on trade, how subject the market is to some whims on some, I guess you would call them political type events, whether it's a trade war with China, a change in the Fed's attitude, or a presidential tweet.
Yeah, you know, volatility has seriously increased since the beginning of 2018, because, you know, from January until February or so, you had like a 12% decline. Then we kind of bottomed in April, and into the summer and the fall, you had like a 15% advance. And then, of course, we peaked. And then we had a decline that was even bigger from that autumn high. We had like a 20% decline. And now we're looking at a 26% advance. So in less than 18 months, you've had at least four double-digit swings in the S&P 500, and it hasn't got much to show because it's back near its January 2018 high. So it's kind of like a big, wild consolidation. But again, as long as it remains above that 200-day and the breadth indicators remain net bullish, I'll stay on the side of the bulls.
So as you're looking at this market, given where we are right now, up until a couple of weeks ago, we were at record levels. The market, your indicators, six out of the nine are bullish. As an investor, Art, what would you be doing right now, given where the market is?
Well, I still think there are some pockets of interest out there. And, you know, one group that really continues to remain strong is software and some of the newer ones like Workday and Salesforce.com. It's consolidating after a big advance and it's near a 52-week high. It wouldn't take much to push it to a 52-week high. And Coupa, C-O-U-P-A, C-O-U-P is the symbol. Those software stocks have been quite strong, and that's a pocket of the market that's, you know, it's kind of immune to tariffs because, you know, software is a service and it's not a product that's being manufactured in China and then brought back over. So it's a bit immune in that regard. So I would look to kind of that area of the market, software.
You know, the thing that also strikes me too, whether you're looking at the breakout of Microsoft, which has just been on a tear, a lot of these software companies, I know a number of years ago, if you had Microsoft Office, you bought the software program, you paid for it, and you probably used it for 2 or 3 years. Now everything is more on a payment system. So you have an income stream, which is, you know, it's kind of like almost like the Netflix model. Everybody is going to it. You have health equipment companies like Peloton, the Mirror, the Tonal, which are going to subscription services. I just wonder how much this changes the nature of some of these tech stocks, because now you have a subscription service of steady revenues rather than relying strictly on one-time product sales.
Yeah, it's an amazing switch, and I found myself doing that. You know, I have a number of subscriptions now instead of individual pieces of software that used to be on a CD-ROM that I would have to install. I find it easier in that regard because it is updated more frequently, but I still use it. You mentioned medical device maker. I think the IHI is also looking interesting from a chart perspective, as it kind of consolidates above its rising 200-day moving average and might be poised for a move. But I think that's a benefit, you know, these medical and software companies that get into the subscription model.
You know, what's rather interesting is Silicon Valley tech is getting in the health equipment business, and they're doing it with a subscription. You take, I think, of three companies, Peloton with their bike, now their treadmill. You've got Tonal, which is magnetic weights. You have a company called The Mirror, which is basically a mirror that you can actually see your instructor and do exercises, but they're invading this space. So technology seems to be permeating our lives in just about every aspect of it.
That is true. The disruptors are definitely out there. And that's why I think it's important to be reading a lot so you can keep up with these stocks. And when you see these IPOs come out, you need to put them in your chart list and follow them on a regular basis. Not all of them are going to work out, but that's where the new and exciting disruptor companies are going to be coming from. They're going to be coming from these IPOs usually. And so if you can put those in your chart list and follow them and wait for one of the setups that you like, you can participate in one of these new and exciting industries.
Now, speaking of IPOs, I'd like to get your take on Uber and Lyft. Both have gone public. Lyft is still having difficulties. What's your take on those two stocks?
Well, when it comes to the IPOs, I usually kind of let them settle because, you know, you do have those lockup periods and then they need to get past these lockup periods. And if you find out how long the lockup period is, then, you know, a month maybe before, start really focusing on it and watching the price action for a potential move or an upturn. For the valuations on Uber and Lyft, I can't really comment because I don't know enough about them. But I do know that I recently listened to a podcast with Mebane Faber, and he was interviewing the NYU finance professor, Aswath Damodaran, and he was talking about Uber and Lyft and thought they were a bit overvalued at this stage, but he preferred Lyft.
Yeah, it's amazing because one of the companies said they're not even close to making money. So maybe that has something to do with it. Art, as we close, I want to talk about your software program. You have something that's kind of my go-to page every single morning. It's your market summary page. Just about, you guys cover, I can't think of anything you don't cover. You cover major markets, indices, sectors, U.S. industry indexes, international bonds, commodities, the dollar. But recently you added something in each category. So if I look at, for example, major markets, I used to have to click on something and then call up a chart. Right now, all I do is click on the index and the chart appears alongside. I absolutely love this because it makes it so easy to follow what's going on in the market. Tell our listeners about it.
Yeah, I love this feature too. And I check it on a regular basis throughout the day. And if you just go to the homepage and you go to the charts and tools tab up at the top of every web page on stock charts, you can see a link on the right for the summary pages. And it's called the market summary. And when you click on that summary page, you get a top-down look at the markets. So we're going to start with, say, the major indexes, and they'll be listed on the right-hand side. And then on the left-hand side will be a chart. And it'll have the 20, the 50, and the 200-day moving average there, averages, as well as volume. And then there are links, and you just click on those links, and that little chart on the left will refresh. And you don't have to go to another web page. Another one doesn't open up. It just automatically does it on the left. And those charts update as you're looking at them. And so you can just scroll down and you'll get to the sectors. And you can easily look at 11 sectors in a minute or two because the links and the charts are right there. And then we break it down into industry groups and industry group ETFs. We go to international ETFs. U.S. bonds, we go down to commodities. So you go down there and you can see gold, which is taking a bit of a hit today, probably because the dollar is continuing to strengthen. And further down, you can see currencies and market breadth. So it shows you pretty much everything you need to see right on one page, and it updates throughout the day.
Well, I'll tell you, it is my go-to page every single morning when I get up. I turn on my computer. That's the first place I go to because everything I want to know about the markets anywhere or any sector is right there on one page, and it's so convenient. Art, as we close, once again, give out the website if our listeners would like to find more about, in my opinion, one of the best software charting packages on the market.
Yeah, and that page we're talking about, the market summary, is available to anybody. Now, StockCharts members can customize the page to get exactly what they want to see on it. But the page as it is, the default page, has plenty of information available to everybody. We also have free charting. We have articles that are also, there's free articles as well as articles behind the paywall as well, but there's plenty for everybody to read, and we can help your analysis process and help you find good stocks.
Well, it's a fabulous program. Once again, Art, thanks for joining us on the program. That webpage is stockcharts.com, and we've been speaking with Art Hill. Art, all the best. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me, Jim. You too.
Bye-bye.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
You've got some FANG-type stocks in China. You've got Alibaba and Tencent. And so if you've got several FANG-type stocks in that country, two of them not long ago, the Alibaba and the Tencent, would have made it into the top eight market cap companies in the world just a few months ago. And yeah, they've faltered since then, but they're still huge in valuation. And yet, the FANG stocks, plus two additional stocks that ought to be in that list, give you an aggregate market cap that's larger than China, inclusive of the Tencents and Alibabas of their world.
It's been a good year for just about every asset class. Just about everything you're looking at is doing well this year, from bonds to stocks to commodities. But not all commodities are doing well. Let's find out why. Joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report. Dave, I want to start with the precious metals. We have the dollar rising on the day you and I are speaking. So naturally, we've seen gold pull back somewhat. But I know you have a lot of expertise in silver. What's going on with silver? Doesn't seem to be able to get any traction, number one. And number two, with all this technology that we're using today, whether it's tablets or smartphones, they use more silver. Why hasn't silver done better?
Silver has been kind of a passe investment from the peak in late April, early May 2011. And Jim, what we see is that we actually have an inventory build. Now, if you read the latest report from the Silver Institute, they'll tell you we have a deficit, but I put that in quotation marks because really from 2006, well, let me just give the broad brush perspective on above ground inventories of silver. So from 1990 to 2006, we started in 1990 with 2 billion ounces of fine silver investment grade above ground. And that stockpile was eaten down to 500 million ounces roughly in 15 years from 1990 to 2006, which means that there was roughly 100 million ounces that was taken out of that stockpile to be able to meet the demand on the silver supply. But since that time, with the boom that's happened in the early 2000s and China coming on board and doing this, their what I'll call industrial revolution, the mining sector took off like crazy in the early 2000s, and a great deal of new discoveries were made, and a great deal of new production came to the fore. So from 2006 till now, we've rebuilt the above-ground inventories of silver from that 500 million to roughly 2.5 billion ounces of silver. So I think that's the most objective way to look at it. Whether, you know, it's overbought by investors or not can be debated. But as far as what does the above ground situation look like, that's the objective truth. Going further on why, it's one, become a very passe investment. And the gold market, as you know, still has some strength. One is, it's really an establishment metal, even though no one really says it. The facts are the facts. The central banks bought more gold last year than they have in the previous 6 years. They do own it. They do keep it as a tier one asset, and they really don't talk about it. In fact, they do. They usually talk about it in a negative way. But nonetheless, you have a complete inventory buildup in Russia and China, the BRICS countries primarily, with physical gold day after day, month after month, year after year. So gold really has a support level that silver doesn't enjoy because silver is not considered a monetary metal by any of the establishment. So that's one of the main factors. And the other key factor that we mentioned, I think the last time I was on the show, was that the risk profile for silver is much different than the risk profile for gold. And this means that there's a lot of, let's say, retail type, high risk, high reward speculators in the silver market that doesn't exist so much in the gold market. And they are inclined to be rather giddy in their investments, which I mean, move from a lot of their silver investments that weren't doing well, taking their monster boxes, going into their coin dealer. And some of these dealers, especially in Canada, were able to put them into Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, or whatever. So a lot of these guys came in and brought their silver in, sold it at a loss, and speculated into the cryptocurrency world at the right time, and actually not only, you know, recovered their losses, but made huge gains in there. Of course, we've seen that market cool off and it's rebounding now. So that's the long-winded version. But those two things are, it's not a monetary metal by the establishment. A lot of people just gave up on the silver market, and you really don't see much outside of of industry, and I'll touch on that briefly. You're right, Jim. There's more uses for silver, you know, almost every day. That's a slight exaggeration. And you see more push for solar and everything else. And there certainly is an underlying factor. And the industrial demand continues to increase, even as the production continues to increase. I know the last 3 or 4 years, the silver production from mines has fallen off slightly. It's but that's still at a very high level relative to what it was, let's say, in the early 2000s or even 2000, a great deal of silver coming out of the ground. Yes, it's fallen back some. Industrial demand actually stays fairly steady, and there is going to be a lot more demand. I think this 5G rollout, which most people don't talk about as far as what are the implications electronically, is that phone, in almost all cases, not every case, but almost all cases, you're going to take that 4G phone that you have, you're going to send it to the recycling center, and you're going to buy a new phone that's 5G compatible. Think of how many new cell phones are going to be on the market over the next few years.
Dave, I know when I first met you back in the early 2000s, when you introduced me to the concept of silver, you had silver that was kind of trapped in a narrow trading range. Back then, it was between $4 and $5 an ounce. Every time it would get up to close to $5, the commercials were heavily short. They would knock it down to go down to $4. They would get long. If you look at silver trading, it's almost like in a similar range, but this time, let's say $14 to $17. Is the same thing going on? I mean, in other words, whenever we get up to the $17 range, there's just a lot of selling for people looking at the charts. I mean, but it does look like it's in a sort of defined trading range.
Oh, yeah, absolutely correct, Jim. And that's a great insight. At least I think it's a great insight. Yeah, it's the exact number that I used, and there's nothing magic about this, but I was 555 level. Once we broke above 555, it finally moved, and it moved rapidly. We got up to near the 8-something level. This was based on the announcement of the Warren Buffett purchase of 130 million ounces of silver. It actually went all the way up into the high 7s, early low 8s, if I recall correctly. And it actually bounced down and actually had a print or two at the 555 breakout level, which is not unusual for a commodity, especially one like silver. But then we had that was over. In other words, 550 silver was done. You weren't going to buy silver at that level basically ever again. And then it reestablished itself with a new base. But you're exactly right. It's acting very similar. The sentiment is very similar. The dynamics, you know, the price is not reflective of the demand, although the demand is not as strong as it's been in the past. It's always at the margin, as all your listeners know. The investment demand for silver is rather poor relative to not only gold, but almost anything else out there. And if you really wanted to be a value investor, and this isn't because I'm such a silver bull, but there's nothing, I mean nothing on the planet that I know of that you can invest in that's a hard asset that stood the test of time like precious metals that's so undervalued. I mean, silver, and I hope this concept comes across, is cheaper today at 15 than it was at 5 in 2000. Wait a minute, David. You know, 15 is a bigger number than 5. But if you do it from the way I analyze it, meaning the true money supply, the Austrian school, and you look at how many dollars have been printed versus how much metal exists, there's far more paper per ounce of silver now than there was in the early 2000s. I hope I'm making sense to everyone.
Dave, you know, something that had happened last year, and you pointed it out when I had you on the show, it was an anomaly. And that was last August, the U.S. Mint ran out of silver eagles. Now, you told me at the time, it was just because of declining demand, they did not make arrangements to have enough silver. So when it got down into the low 14s, there was a large investment demand that came in that overwhelmed the supply. Was that pretty much the story? And could that happen again? Or is the Mint basically recognizing they need to, let's say, make more silver eagles?
Yeah, you've got it accurate, Jim. Basically, the Mint is, you know, slow to react. And like any business, they don't want to put too much capital expenditure into equipment that isn't going to be utilized. So as the demand for silver eagles went from what it started with in the program in 1986, we were running around 10 million ounces a year for quite some time. Well, once silver became like the best asset you could own for a few years, that ramped up to like 40 million ounces a year. So the Mint did what any good business would do, and they bought more, you know, more machinery, more presses. And of course, that meant more silver, of course. So they met the demand by increasing their production rate by buying more capital equipment. Now they've really got stuff sitting there that's collecting dust because the amount of Silver Eagle demand has fallen off to like in the 20 million an ounce range. So they basically are like most businesses anywhere. If it's a, you know, retail business for women's clothing or whatever, it's just in time inventory. So they always have the belief, false at that, but nonetheless, the belief that they don't need to warehouse hardly any product whatsoever. They have an overcapacity to produce on today's market basis, the fact that they don't need to make 40 million ounces of Silver Eagles anymore right now. And so they just were basically short when they all of a sudden got a demand. They had to call up their supplier and say, oh, hey, send us some silver. We need to press out more Eagles. We've got a demand again.
You know, the thing that always amazes me, and I don't care if you're looking at silver, looking at gold, you're looking at copper. We live in this high-tech world, David. In fact, on the day you and I are speaking, I just saw a news story on the financial cable channels talking about colonizing space or the moon. So we live in this high-tech society. We're going to 5G. Our smartphones are sophisticated computers. We have tablets. We got internet everywhere. But people forget that smartphone in your hand requires a metal. If you're going to build an electric car, you're going to be using more copper. And yet the base metals or the precious metals have really not held up that well. And I think maybe we get to a point where everybody's thinking high-tech, but we forget all this high-tech stuff still runs on real stuff and made of real stuff.
It does. I mean, I've got a speculation. I know I can't talk stocks on the program and I won't, but today over 50 million tons of electronic waste is produced annually on a worldwide basis. And the United Nations is predicting that to grow to 78 million tons on an annual basis in the next 4 years. That works out to 148 tons of electronic waste produced every 60 seconds. Or to put that into perspective, that's enough electronic waste to fill 240 Olympic swimming pools every day, or the total volume of 15 Houston Astrodomes every month. This year, the United States produced over 11 million tons of electronic waste from IT-based components such as computers, laptops, data servers, cell phones, box top sets like your cable TV situation. And these things are largely discarded and go into landfills. So this is a huge opportunity for people to capture what I call urban mining. And the situation that I've basically only a writer about on this topic. There's one other guy that's written about it only from a technical aspect. But the annual production of electronic consumers is estimated to be 350 tons of gold, 7,500 tons of silver, and 300,000 tons of copper. And that's a value of about $62 billion every year. Yet the UN reports that less than 25% of these electronics are actually recycled. So there's a huge opportunity here. And it's one, again, that's not very well known, but I just want to point out, Jim, and back you up on your statement, that, you know, if you can't be growing, it has to be mined. And no matter how green you are, or how green you want to be, the facts are the facts. And you need metals to run a high-tech society, especially a lot of this stuff, especially in like the wind, how the wind farms, and a lot of stuff is rare earth elements and high-tech with high-tech metals involved. And it can't be done any other way. There are no substitutes. And this is a situation that at some point, I think we'll have a wake-up call. I'm still bullish on the metals. I could comment on that further, what I think needs to take place before we see a lift, especially in the silver market. But nonetheless, I do think it will occur.
Well, you know, I just take a look at this and I take a look at the consumption. I also take a look at whether you're looking at copper, gold. You're not making new discoveries. You don't have the juniors that are out there making discoveries and they're getting bought out by the larger companies. What you do see is what we've seen this year. You've got Barrick buying Randgold. You've got Newmont buying Goldcorp. So the only way they're replenishing their reserves, David, is to go mining on Wall Street. So, you know, I've been buying copper companies. I'm buying silver because I just take a look at the prices where they are today. And then I just look around me in this technology world that we live in. And I know, like anybody else, you have to make stuff. And to make stuff, you need raw materials. And the raw materials are in disfavor right now.
Absolutely. Well, you're a great contrarian and you're willing to, move with the markets. I mean, you did great with the gold market when it was a bull market. It peaked in September 2011, and you kind of changed your methodology. And that's what you should do. A good money manager. Absolutely. In fact, any good investor should do the same thing. And we are at a low in silver, and copper looks inviting. I wasn't that bullish on copper for a while, but I am now with the EV market and everything that is required. Plus, the charged copper doesn't really look that bad. But you're right, Jim. It's time to look at value. That's where the value lies. It's no one's looking at that sector. And as far as where I see the market going, I'm pretty convinced at this point that not only is gold the most negatively correlated asset to the stock market, if you look at the stock market making new highs, then that implies gold should be making new lows. And that's not exactly true. But the point being that gold's actually holding up fairly well. 1280 is kind of my marker in the sand. I want to see it continue to hold the 1280 level or better. And today we're off $10. And as we're doing, it's slightly under that. I do think we have to take another run or two at the $1,300 level. And once we do that, that's a psychological support. 1350, 1360 is kind of the magic number from the technical perspective, which means that until we get to that level, really, you could just kind of bide your time if you want to get into an investment and be relatively assured that you're buying it correctly. Most people want to buy something and it goes up from that point in time forward. If you have that kind of a mindset, then wait until gold proves itself at that level I just outlined. But if you want to buy value, I would definitely be accumulating at these levels because, again, this is a very under-known sector, unwanted, and really washed over. You don't hear much about the precious metals, copper, or any of the metals in the news at all. And that's the time to buy it when it's very quiet and no one really wants it.
You know, I think one of the biggest catalysts going forward, David, and I think we're going to see this come about. We've seen it with the Trump administration and more likely in the next decade, and that is MMT or Modern Monetary Theory, which is, one of the oldest tricks in the world used by politicians. It's basically the government spends money and the Fed prints the money to monetize it. And it's gained traction in both parties. You've got both the left and the right talking about nobody's talking about the deficit anymore. It's going to be nearly $1 trillion this year with 3% economic growth and the lowest unemployment in five decades, and yet the deficit's $1 trillion. So what are they going to do in the next decade when entitlements will be larger, the government will be spending more? I think the figure by the CBO, by 2026, entitlements and interest on the debt will consume 100% of the government's revenues. So they're talking about this MMT as if this is some new scientific economic theory. It's basically tax, spend, and print money.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about this, this call today. And I remember several summers ago where you spent, I think, most of the summer looking at, what happens on these great inflations. And you discovered that no one has ever seen a deflationary environment when it's based on a fiat system. If it was a gold-backed system, then you might see a deflationary environment. But ultimately, if you don't have an unbacked situation, you're going to get into at least a inflation, if not a hyperinflation. And certainly headed toward that direction. This MMT absolutely drives me nuts because of what I've learned throughout all of my life about monetary history, not only theoretical, but historically. And yet, it seems to be the flavor de jour. I remember, they think it's a movie clip where Dick Cheney, and it might have been an actual clip from a newsreel years ago, saying, well, Ronald Reagan proved that deficits don't matter. Like, you just magically wave your wand like King Kuna Kinte and go out and say the waves, stop the waves. You cannot outrule economic law. You cannot. There's a natural force in economics. And I think Mises is one of the best at explaining how that really takes place with all he's written. I mean, look at Human Action and some of the other books on the subject. But we're going to go, most likely, as you said, more socialistic, more free things for everybody, print and spend, until someone somewhere, and I'm saying this collectively, until the consciousness of the market itself says, this can't go on forever, and there's a shift of some type. And it could be a radical one, meaning that you could one day wake up and there is a repricing in the bond market, or repricing in the equity market, or repricing in the gold market, or maybe all at the same time. I don't know. I don't know exactly how it's going to unravel. What I do know is you cannot outsmart economic law. It cannot be done. And yet they're going to probably continue to go down the path you just outlined.
Yeah, I see eventually kind of what happened in the 30s, but I see a major, you know, it could be, I don't know, maybe Trump in his second term if he gets elected, or another American president, whoever that may be, eventually major devaluation of the dollar, very much like Nixon did in the 70s. David, as we close, you write the Morgan Report. You cover a lot of what goes on in metals, base metals, and natural resources. Tell our listeners more about what you do and how they can find out more information.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, the best thing to do is go to our main landing page, which is themorganreport.com, and get on our free email list. We do send out offers that I vet. Sometimes they're for mining companies. That's very rare. I wouldn't put anything up there that I didn't like. Occasionally a coin dealer, but you can overlook those. What I do do is every interview I do like this one, if the host allows it, I'll post it to that email list. On top of that, I do what's called the weekly perspective. I try to keep that around 12 minutes. And I look at the big news for the week. And then I always finish with a commentary about the precious metals. So I think it's a time saver for most people. It's kind of a wrap up of the news with my editorial on it. Like, well, deficits don't matter, but look at all these layoffs. The economy is great, but look at the retail sector and how good it really is doing, and that type of commentary. Try to keep you on track, similar to what you do, Jim, but it's in a very small format, meaning it's a very tight 10-15 minute type of situation. So you'll get that for free. We also do webinars for free. I talked about how to speculate effectively, and those are still available. If you don't want the mailing list, which is the easiest way to do it, you can find me on most of the social platforms, Twitter feed, YouTube channel is probably the best, because most of the interviews I do, I post there as well. And I just do it basically as a public service, because my mission statement hasn't changed. I really want everyone to understand the benefits of an honest financial system. And we certainly have a system now that has been corrupted like almost everything else that we encounter on a daily basis. So it doesn't mean that the, let's say, the lantern of truth isn't going to shine brightly at some point. As I said earlier, and to reiterate, we have a situation that they can do the modern portfolio or modern MMT, modern money theory, all they want, but eventually a price has to be paid. If you're aware of that and prepared for that, you don't have to really have much angst or fear about it. You just have to know that it exists and how to prepare properly, which means have your asset classes defined properly so that you are prepared for the eventual reset of what these price mechanisms are going to be when the eventuality of this, you cannot get something for nothing, takes hold in the public consciousness, and the markets themselves reflect that reality.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Dave, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. Have yourself a great weekend.
I will, Jim, and thanks for having me on the show. It's great to be with you.
And coming up in hour two, the big picture, Jim Poplava and I discuss the economics of inflation. We're at a key inflection point in our economy and the markets, especially as we head into the 2020 presidential elections. Both political parties subscribe to an economic theory that has had and will have disastrous results, MMT. Or modern monetary policy. We talk about that, and in the second half of the big picture, we play Jim's interview with Jens O. Parsons, aka Ronald Marks. Though the interview is from 2013, I think you'll find it's more relevant now as the U.S. government moves toward MMT.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any company companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.